Hello and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This was recorded live at DFTB 19. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find all our back catalogue available on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy!
So we're going to move on to our final speaker, so Justin Hensley, which we have to thank you very much for stepping in at very short notice, and we had a speaker drop out at short notice, and Justin has kindly agreed to talk for us on wilderness medicine. Justin is from Texas, and he's also brought the youngest PICU fellow with him, Jack. So yeah, let's give a warm welcome to Justin.
Hi everybody. Thank you for letting me speak to you, and my slides have gone away, which is terrifying. We're going to talk about wilderness medicine, which isn't retrieval, but it's interesting. So I'm married to a pediatrician. Obviously, I have children, which makes this important to me. Studies have shown that children who are exposed to the wilderness early do better with things such as childhood exercise capability. They have less obesity. We used to call them fat camps. Now we call them wilderness camps, where you send kids and get out in the wilderness. And so they'll be exposed to the wilderness. And so knowing what to do in that case is important. I am a toxinologist by trade. I didn't do a toxicology fellowship, but I can do wilderness venoms. And, oh, look, backwards. All right. So the wilderness myths we're going to talk about are various and sundry. There are some wilderness myths. You'll get most of them are on television. If you see anything any of these people do, realize that it may not be based in reality. It's very good for TV, but it's not good for actual practice. Especially our favorite Bear Grylls down there, who has a new TV show where you can also interact with him on Amazon and answer things incorrectly as well. So just realize that and take it with a grain of salt. He loves it. I don't. We'll start off with my favorite, which is the venoms. And so this is a rattlesnake. It's a Crotalus species, common to North America. It's the biggest group of venomous snakes we have. Here in the UK and Europe, we have the adder, which is the Crotalin species that has necrotoxic venom. Australia, literally everything is venomous, so just avoid them all at all costs. But there's a lot of myths about what to do, and so people will say use a tourniquet or a tourniquet, depending on where you're from. They say arterial, venous, or lymphatic. This is a lymphatic one being demonstrated because you can put your finger in there. Realize that that's not what you want to do. Electricity. If you have an afternoon to amuse yourself, realize that there are YouTube videos of people out there using electricity to try and denature or do other things to the venom to help with that. That is not very useful, but it is comical. I'm just going to let you know that. There are a myriad of case reports. There's a guy out there that patented a stun gun of sorts to do it, so just realize that electricity is bad. Ice, also not good. Vasoconstricts locally, increases local venom effects. Sawyer, the company, makes a commercially available venom extraction device. It is the epitome of why we shouldn't use online rankings for things. Everybody's like, this is so cool, it's so great, 5 stars. It literally doesn't work. There are studies that show that if you use radio tracers and put this on, it will suck out 0.000 and some change venom. And so that's not very useful. But what it does suck out is serum. So the venom is actually more concentrated in the skin, so it makes it even worse. It's really super fantastic. And our favorite, also don't do this. And the reason is because all of these are going to increase your local venom effects, and that's what we don't want. What you really need to do is car keys and either diesel or Jet A, and that will help you get to definitive care. That lets you do what you need to do to get them the antivenom if such a thing exists. Also, it lets you not harm them more. So the goal is to not harm them more, right? If, on the other hand, you do live in Australia and you have the inland taipan or any other Southeast Asian species of snakes that are purely neurotoxic, there's actually good evidence for using things such as the pressure immobilization bandage, if you know how to use it. Now, I think in Australia, they teach it to you in preschool, but everywhere else, we're not really taught how to do it. And so we don't do it correctly. And if you don't do it correctly, you can actually push that venom towards the central nervous system and make them paralyzed faster and they die sooner. So if you know how to use it, use it. If you don't, lay off for a while. If you have the Naha species, so you've got some cobras in your area, realize that they can have any combination of venoms that are necrotoxic or neurotoxin. So unless you're like a herpetologist or really good at speciating cobras, just don't do anything. Just avoid them at all costs, unless you're a mongoose, and then you might be able to win that battle, right? Other venoms that I like to talk about. So jellyfish, real common. For some reason in the States, we all have this myth of using baking soda or meat tenderizer, like you're going to denature the venom protein outside the skin. They don't work. Please, for the love of God, unless you're into it, don't pee on the patient. It does not help. There may be some basis to it, but really it doesn't help. Don't do it. Use vinegar. Vinegar will deactivate the nematocysts. It will make them stop firing. They'll stop injecting venom into the skin, at which point you can either pluck them off, scrape them off, or pull them off with your hands if you're using a glove. But what you really want to do is hot water. Now, I realize this is a very controversial topic on how hot you should drink your tea, but you want this water that touches the skin to be between 40 and 45 centigrade, and that will denature the protein in the skin. It'll help with immediate pain relief. And this works for other aquatic species, things like stingrays. Centipedes are very closely related to lobsters, and so if you get stung by a centipede, because they sting, they don't bite. The parts that sting you are not modified mandibles. They're actually forelegs, technical term. So the hot water actually works for those as well. So you can use hot water on that. It'll denature the venom. It'll make it feel a lot better. Other myths. So water. Do you need to filter or purify the water you drink if you're out in pristine nature? You know, that water's coming off of that glacier, right? Unless humans have never been there and there's no domesticated animals anywhere within 100 miles or 160 kilometers, or if there are no big collections of actual wilderness species there, you need to purify that water. And realize the concept of a bubbling stream, like you think it's really fast moving, it's going to be better, right? It's actually kicking up infectious particles from the bottom. So the purest water you can drink in the wilderness is going to be those top couple inches of a lake where the UV light from the sun has actually filtered and killed all those bacteria. So if you've got a still lake, you can drink those top couple inches. But in a survival situation, just drink any water. Don't be like, I can't drink that. Unless it's something nasty, then don't drink it maybe. Don't drink pure mud, right? But if there's water out there, yes, you're probably going to get diarrhea or some other type of GI sickness, but it won't start for about 48 hours, and hopefully you'll be found before then. So don't go out expecting to drink the water, but if you're trying to survive, you can start drinking the water. Whatever you do, don't do this. Now, this container would be really good for solar UV distillation. So you just put water in it, put it out in the sun for 4 hours. It'll kill all the stuff in there. Won't work if it's real cloudy. But what it won't do is make your urine somehow palatable or better for you. Your kidneys, as everyone knows, are smarter than you. And they've already filtered as much as you possibly can. And so you've got like an ultra concentrate of what you can get out of you. You're not going to get any free water by drinking that again. You know, we don't have a re-drinker capability. So while I may never be as good looking or as rich as this man, I don't have memes about me drinking my own urine, which is all I can hope for. Now, if you do retrieval, or if you do any kind of EMS, if you've done any wilderness courses, you've seen one of these. This is an improvised traction splint. I'm not sure why in wilderness teaching, the only bone anybody ever breaks is their femur, not their tib fib, not their humerus, not anything else. It's always their femur, and you always have to come up with this Rube Goldberg device where you take a ski pole and you rig up some type of pulley system with a rope or a torn shirt or whatever to get some traction on their leg. You ever tried to use one of these? They're terrible. They don't work. They're flimsy. They stick out past the end of the stretcher, so if you're trying to put them in anything, you're trying to shut the doors, it's hitting the end of this thing. It doesn't work. Don't do it. If you have the mythical broken femur, and you've got anything around, you can pat it and roll it up on itself and basically give itself a splint. If you've got pre-made long legs, say you're doing retrieval actually, you get pre-made long leg splints, they work really well for this. If you lack any of that, say you're purely in the wilderness and you know they've got a broken femur, their leg is moving right here, the thigh compartment's swelling up a little bit and you need to immobilize that, you can buddy tape their legs together and their good leg is a really good splint for their bad leg. It also bends at the knee, which helps when they need to jump, but you don't make them jump. So it really works really well if you absolutely have low resources. Other things people like to do for improvisation, as he speaks, should you use ink pens for airways? And if you're going to use an ink pen, should you use this $200 Mont Blanc? Sorry, 120-pound Mont Blanc, I don't know the conversion rate right now. So this study in 2016, the BMJ, from a group of people in Munich, so I'm not sure what the international coalition there was, showed that, no, you take 10 consultant emergency doctors and give them all just standard ink pens and ask them on cadavers to establish an airway, one gets in the trachea and the other 9 get somewhere else, and some of, or don't get anywhere at all. A lot of it has to do with strength. So I don't know what you all are writing with, but what I write with usually isn't real sharp, and I'm not able to get through all those tissues with it. And so if you're using enough force to get it through those tissues, it keeps going and goes through the back and goes in the esophagus and goes all the way into the soft tissue. It doesn't really help. So even if you get it into the airway, their studies show that unless it has a big enough inner diameter, you're not going to ventilate or oxygenate them. It just doesn't do anything. It doesn't get the oxygen in. It doesn't get the CO2 out. So you're not going to help a whole lot. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't improvise if you know what you're doing and you have an adequate tool. So this airway, although it looks like just a normal ET tube shoved in somebody's neck, you notice that there's no balloons and no handy-dandy writing on the outside of it. So this is the drinking straw from a bladder hydration device. So basically this is somebody's camelback that they made an airway out of. Now it helps if when you fall and smash your face and need an airway, that you've got 3 firefighters and emergency doc that are skiing next to you, that see you go down and have these tools to do this. So they basically made that device out of that equipment. And so if you've got the right equipment and it makes rational sense, and the only situation is when you cannot not do it, so that's gonna be they're gonna die or they're gonna be something else, you're really out there, you can use it, but don't use the wrong tool because you're not gonna make any benefit and you're just gonna make them hurt more as they die. Lightning. Really enjoy lightning myths. There's quite a few of them. I'm not sure why people have so many lightning myths, but the biggest one is it doesn't bother you until it starts raining, which apparently is every day here anyway. So do you need to worry about lightning? Yes, lightning can precede a storm by over 10 miles. And so the easiest rule to think of is the 30-30 rule. If you see lightning and you hear thunder within 30 seconds, go inside. Get away from things that you're going to get struck by lightning on because it will hit you. And after the last thunderclap you hear, or the last lightning you see, if you can't hear the thunderclap anymore, then wait 30 minutes before you go back outside because that's when it's safe. Because that electrical voltage, that static electricity with millions of kilovolts, will still get you miles and miles away. The whole see the lightning, count the seconds, and then when you hear the thunderclap, that's how many miles away it is. That doesn't work because, number one, lightning strikes in more than one place at once, and so the one you're counting may be one that's further away than the one you see. They could be stacked on top of each other. There's lots of things, so don't try and count it. Just use 30 seconds and 30 minutes as your rule. Also, for whatever reason, the layperson bystanders often thinks that this electrocuted person from lightning still has residual charge, and so they won't touch them. Absolutely not true. Lightning is God's way of rebooting our central nervous system. And that takes about 3 minutes. Apparently they're running Windows. It's not a Mac system. So it takes about 3 minutes. So if you can support them cardiovascularly during that 3 minutes until their brain takes back over, they usually will do pretty well. And so that's when you use reverse triage. Lightning strikes mass casualty. It'll hit. One person will be down on the ground not breathing. 5 people walking around screaming because their eardrums are blown out. One person may be burned. But you need to do CPR on the person, unlike a normal mass casualty where if they're not breathing, they're dead. We need to move on. So realize that. They also don't generally get burned. Less than a third of lightning strike victims have visible burns. Their clothing will be burned off, their shoes can be blown off, but they won't be burned on the skin. Lightning takes the path of least resistance. If it's usually raining outside, your wet skin is where these lightning waves travel over. Sometimes they'll travel through your nerves and your blood vessels, and they can cause some temporary or even permanent neuropathic damage, but realize you don't generally get burned with these things, and so you may not be able to see any visible outside injury. Finally, to end, we're going to talk about one of the most misunderstood parts of wilderness, and that's cold. That's what Bear was always trying to demonstrate, where he's always trying to build a fire and trying to eat and do other things. So, if your feet are cold, should you wear a hat? Are you going to lose most of your heat through your head? The answer to that's kinda. The problem is the head does not have any better heat transfer to the outside world than any other part of your skin. Transfers about the same rate. It won't vasoconstrict like your hands will, and so it does do a little less than, say, the absolute extremities, but it's the same as your chest and your thorax and everything else. The difference is those things are usually clothed and your head usually isn't. And so, yes, you do lose heat and a hat will help you, but it's not going to do anything for your feet. And so if your feet are cold, put on better socks or better shoes or whatever. Don't just think a hat's going to make your whole body warm. It'll make your head a little warmer. But we generally don't radiate most of our heat away anyway, so it's not like you're going to get hypothermic because you're not wearing a hat. What about if somebody's cold? Say you see somebody shivering, and they might even be at the limit of mild hypothermia, which starts around 32 centigrade. So any colder than that, you get the moderate hypothermia. Mild hypothermia, they're shivering. They might be even shivering really hard, so not violently, uncontrollably, but they'll be shivering. So you're like, hey, mate, I'm going to make you feel better. Here is 300 milliliters of tea at 45 Celsius. Is that going to do anything for their temperature? It might make his fingers feel better, his or her, but it's not going to do anything. So if you take an 80 kilogram individual, and I have to adjust the math because we don't have any of those actually in America. Everybody's slightly above that. So if you take an 80 kilogram person, they are 75% water. So 56 kilograms of them is water. You take tea, a liter of tea, 43.3 centigrade, and you pour that into a 56-liter vat of water that's at 32 degrees Celsius, you are going to raise the temperature of that 0.2 Celsius. It is just not going to make a significant difference. You are not going to help them. But you know what will? Sugar. So the reason we stay warm at all costs is our mitochondria are furnaces, and they will burn energy. And so unfortunately, they're not really into the keto diet, and so they need sugar. And so if you give somebody sugars, even sickly sweet things, it will actually help them have more energy. That's why if you have somebody that's hypothermic and you see them shivering, you want to check a finger stick on them because their blood glucose is going to be really low because they're going to burn through their glycogen really fast. You only have about 30 to 60 minutes of useful shivering before you're out, and then you stop, and then you get colder real fast. So while the mimosa may not be the best option, I want to go where they ski. Sugar, sickly sweet things are good. So if you give them tea, warm tea is fine. Put some sugar in it. But what you don't want to do is just dump them in the hot tub. So we vasoconstrict. The central body will actually help quite a bit with vasoconstriction. So much so that if you put a commercially available heating blanket on their skin, you can cause first and second degree burns, even at lower temperatures, because the body can't pull that heat away. It doesn't take as much. So you don't want to do anything on the periphery, you want to do it centrally. If you dump them in a hot tub, you're going to massively peripherally vasodilate them, maybe cause some burns, but also cause their cardiovascular system to collapse because they're suddenly just going to shunt everything out because they've already had their cold diuresis, which is how they're able to peripherally vasoconstrict to begin with. So you don't want to do that. But any other commercially available device, if you've got an ambient warmer, a forced air radiator, a bear hugger, if you just want to take the exhaust from, you know, the ambient heat off the machinery, that will help. Don't pump the CO2 exhaust into them. That might actually kill them, but you want to use other sources of heat. And so those are okay. Do they have to be cold and dead? Not really. Jack, unfortunately, you know, he'd been fine if she'd let him up on all that extra space on the door. But, so, you know, yes, the mantra of they're not dead until they're warm and dead. So, unfortunately, that's not true, because you can be dead and cold, right? So if you're under the ice for 18 hours, or you're in a snowbank for 24 hours, or you get pulled out and you've got any snow impacted in the hypopharynx, you know, anything in the airway, or if your chest is frozen solid, or you have a traumatic injury that would be incapable of life if you were also warm, you don't need to do anything. These are expensive resources, retrieval, resuscitation. You know, the Swiss Alps, they've got a myriad of helicopters that all cost thousands and thousands of euros every time they get up in the air. Don't risk their lives in bad weather. Don't risk other people's lives in bad weather for patients that aren't salvageable. So yes, they can be cold and dead. And finally, don't get in the sleeping bag with them naked. That's a great thing on TV. But realize, so the warm person starts sweating, which puts water on the cold person. The cold person stops shivering because they've got some ambient warmth. And more importantly, you don't want to deal with the HR fallout of why were you naked in the sleeping bag with the patient? So you want to do a hypothermia wrap where you get their wet clothes off. They can be naked. They might need to be naked if their clothes are wet. But you want to get their clothes off. You want to wrap them up, get them protected from the elements, and let their own furnace warm them up, which is the more effective way. And with that, I end. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Justin. Who needs Bear Grylls? Thanks for all that myth busting. There's also more myth busting to be had on Justin's EBM Gone Wild. Does anybody have any myths they'd like busted?
Well, actually, it's not really a myth.
Yeah, it could be a question.
Yeah. Just with active rewarming with fluids,
mm-hmm.
would it then be better to be using a glucose-based fluid?
I would say so, yes.
Because
unfortunately, there's not a lot of studies on it, but when I do for my South Texas rewarming, yes, I use dextrose retaining fluids.
Seb, anything from Twitter?
So it's from Norwich Pem, who've been following. So if 1 liter of tea only raises the temperature by 0.2 degrees, are you advocating 20 liters of tea as treatment for mild hypothermia? Because it's something we think as a nation we could get on board with.
I'm okay with that, yeah. If you can tolerate it. All right.
Anything else from the room?
Jack.
Basically, only drinking a lot of warm liquid will only make you pee more, which will make you dry out.
Yeah. Says the youngest picky fellow ever.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, if there's nothing else from the room, I think we'll wrap up. So thank you very much to our amazing three speakers, Justin, Kostas, and Ariane. And thank you for coming and all your questions.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Don't Forget the Bubbles. This was recorded live at DFTB 19. If you enjoy this podcast, you can find all our back catalogue available on iTunes and Spotify. Enjoy!